I think we'll give this shiur tonight for the doctors here, especially those in the high-risk fields. So we'll speak about laughter. Laughter is not a very funny subject in Jewish terms, spiritually. I'm trying to understand why. For the last few weeks we've been speaking about the das, inner wisdom, the root of the hidden wisdom, the faculty that women have specially, as we try to explain, and we'll try and see how this faculty of what laughter means spiritually is particularly strong in the female pole also. The principle in the spiritual world that we've discussed many times is as follows. The mystics say this, that just like the body can only express what the mind wants, that means when you see a meaningful human action, you understand that it was motivated by a hidden dimension that you couldn't see. That means a person, let's say they wanted to be kind to you. So they, because of that desire which you couldn't see, they activate the physical level. That means the hand gives you something. But when you relate to the physical thing, that's a very meaningless level. You see only an organic, you see only a physical event in the world, but a hand gets put into a pocket and it takes out something and it gives you something. But what's meaningful to you is the hidden dimension behind it. You understand from that that the person's generous. Or if a person says a kind word to you when you need it. So again, you don't relate to the fact that the muscles of their mouth are twitching, that there's some sounds are being generated in the world. That's not what's meaningful to you. It's only a tool that's used in order to convey to you that there's something meaningful going on in the spiritual world. I mean, that we have a natural feeling for being able to abstract that. Now, that we don't focus on the physical event. What we do is we understand the depth behind it, and that's what we relate to. Now, one level higher than that is the following idea, that anything that's expressed in the physical is only the crystallization of the way that thing is spiritually. Now, we've discussed this many times. That means that in Jewish terms, the body looks the way it does only because the neshama, that means the core, the spiritual core of your being, is that way. That is, the neshama has organs like the body does, I mean, in an abstracted sense. And that's the core and the reason behind why the body looks the way it does. A man looks different from a woman physically, because spiritually, the core is different. Right? And so it goes with everything in the world. The physical thing only looks the way it does because the spiritual root has that shape in abstraction. That's why the mystics look at the body a very different way from a scientist. Right? The scientist looks at how things function physically. The mystic or person of spiritual insight tries to understand, if the body looks this way, it must be that the reason, the core, the concept behind it, right, is the spirit. The mystics say, for example, that certain mystical qualities that reside in the depths of the spiritual world have an aspect that's called right, and there's some things that live there that are called left. We're not going to go into this, just an example, right? Or male and female. But when they're expressed in the world, then that which was male in the spiritual world looks female in the physical world, and vice versa. And if you go into the mystical texts which describe this phenomenon, an exact parallel of neurology. If you read a neurology textbook that describes how the tracts on the right side of the brain cross over to the left side of the body, that's an exact description, right down to the finest details. That's because the spiritual pattern that's the basis of everything that's in the physical world, that determines the way the physical world looks. Now, we've had occasion to discuss different aspects of this, what the physical manifestation tells you about the spiritual core. Then let's go one stage deeper. The same is true on any level. That means if you wanted to take a spiritual thing and you could study the spiritual thing, the abstract thing, and understand it, you would then be able to abstract one stage deeper and see what the spiritual core of that thing is. Right? And the thing that you're studying would look very physical relative to the root of that thing. And that goes on in an infinite series. Most of us can't hold it beyond just right one stage between body and mind, or if you're very, very adept, mind and the spiritual root of what the mind is. And the mystics have ways of tracing it further. Now, if that's true, if that premise is true, and it's the basis of Jewish thinking, it's the basis of the understanding of the mystical world, then it follows that if you take an emotion or a human experience, as opposed to an organ in the body, if you take a human experience, it follows that if you understand it carefully, you understand well what the spiritual root of that thing is. You don't have to look at a piece of the body, you can look at an experience of the human, and you can learn how to abstract that. Now, what are the rules?
You with me? One note somewhere? The example I hope will make it easier, clearer. The rules are that since we don't have a sense organ that can tune into the abstract, right? We don't have a sense organ that can feed another human being. When you relate to a human being, even very intimately for 50 years, let's say, but you still don't have any organ that can actually sense the inner being, what that person really is. The most you can ever do is see the tip of their nose. Right? You never see more than the piece of steak that they inhabit. Right? That's what the mystics say. You live in a piece of physical tissue that's no more elevated than a monkey's. So you can't, and you never see more than that. But it's by studying what that low piece of tissue does that you understand through a power of abstraction what it means inwardly, although you never can relate to the inward thing directly. So the trick is this, the question is this: how are you ever expected to understand the core of reality, which is abstract and spiritual, if you haven't been given a tool to deal with it? The answer is, you study the physical manifestation, because it's an exact parallel, like the mystics say, it's like a stem, and the image that's made, what's called chetam, chetam the nechtam, it's like the image of a stem. If you want to know what the stamp looked like, you study the imprint that's left on the paper. Don't think you're looking at the same thing. It's a mile apart. You're not looking at the same thing at all, but it's an exact replica, because nothing could be there unless it was in the core. Of course, you have to know certain rules. For example, when you look at an impression that was made by a stamp, what's sunken, yeah, it's reversed, what's sunken in the image was raised on the thing that caused it. Right and left reversed as they come down. That's not in our subject. You have to know certain rules, though. But the basic rule is that by accurate study of what it is that you can grasp, you can abstract and understand what the root is, even though you don't have a place to put that in the mind, and even though it can never be put into words, and even though you can never conceptualize it physically or see a picture or a diagram, but there's a place in the mind. This idea isn't so hard if you always keep relating to the example that we used. When you relate to a human being at any level, you always are really intuiting what the person is inside. And you're always doing it only through a very crude, not nervous and muscle, you know, sort of system of very, very crude organic tissue, which isn't any different from an animal. That's the basic reference point always to come back to. Now, in that introduction, if you take the human experience of laughter, now what does it mean and what does it connect with in the spiritual world? How does this connect, this function of the das, this aspect of inner wisdom, what's it got to do? You see, if you're brought up in the Western mold and you think like an evolutionist, then the discussion's over already. Because you probably think that laughter evolved because it had some survival value, because otherwise the tension got so bad you chewed yourself up or you got lethal ulcers or something. So you follow. At some stage in the evolutionary thing, if you could develop the ability to laugh, so then it's like you could survive. That's why there's no spiritual discussion at that kind of level. We understand that if people laugh, there's an experience called laughter, that it has to be that it's an expression of a very deep spiritual root. They're right about survival value, but much more deeply than they think. That's the real spiritual core of survival has to be connected to this thing. The rule would be then that you take the human experience, you analyze what it is, you see what the crude experience is without trying to make any spiritual understanding, just see what the thing is and how it works, and then use that same power of abstraction to see what it must be in the root. Yeah? So if we understand, if we look at the experience of laughter, and just try and make a few observations about what it is, then we could begin to understand something, a very, very deep secret about the world. The reason that the subject is not funny is because it's the subject of crisis. Yeah? The concept of laughter is the reversal that happens when it's least expected and least possible. That's what it is. Let's try and understand. And that's what crisis is, crisis and redemption. The theme of the world, in Jewish terms, is crisis and redemption. Right? It's about to be lost, and then at the least likely, most critical, most impossible moment, that's when revelation or redemption happens. But only then. It couldn't happen at any other time. So let's try and understand what this means. So if you look at the human experience, let's start like that, and then you see this. What is laughter? What's called funny in the world? So you'll see that the human experience is we respond to something called, we respond with laughter to an experience where an event or a sequence of events has a certain shape, and then suddenly that thing reverses itself. The more the reversal, the sharper the reversal, and the timing, the less likely the timing, the funnier the thing is. Right? That's how we respond. If you think about it, you'll see that actually it's very difficult to understand, because intrinsically there's nothing funny about the event. But if you analyze what we laugh at, you'll see that intrinsically, intellectually, in terms of what makes sense, there's nothing funny about what we laugh at. It's just the sudden juxtaposition of two opposites.
or the reversal of a situation into an extreme opposite version of what it was before, even when there's nothing funny about it at all. Now, here's a tall, elegant man walking down the street, slips on a banana peel and falls flat on his back. Right? Now, there's nothing funny about that. It's painful, not funny. That should evoke a very painful experience in you, but it doesn't. Even the person is running to help him, but he can't hide a smile. Because what happens is, people laughing at that kind of thing are very lowly developed in spiritual. But the point is that what's funny about it, even though in human terms it's not funny, there's nothing. Humor always connects with happiness. Intrinsic to the experience of humor is always an experience of happiness. Always. Right? It's not a sad experience, it's an experience of happiness. And yet there's nothing happy about that kind of event. That it's a very strange phenomenon. The evolutionist has to do a lot of hard work to understand what kind of survival value that kind of twist has. But in spiritual terms, you have to understand this. The reason we love is because that's the definition of the experience. It's not that there's something intrinsically, what intellectually you might think is funny. It's because when one thing becomes its radical opposite, that's what evokes what's called laughter. Right? Of course, if you don't think about spiritual depth, then that's the experience. They don't think about it further. But our job on a Monday night, we're supposed to speak about mysticism. Our job is to try and understand what it means in the root. Right? If that is an experience that the human has at the level of what's called emotions, then it must be that in the root of the human, right, in the core of what it is to be human, and in the root of the spiritual structure of the universe, there must be this thing called laughter. Right? The world has to laugh. But you know that all, not here to support other spiritual systems, but if you've ever studied anything Eastern, you'll know that they always talk about the laughing man. Right? We're not. The last thing in our minds is to bring a proof to Kabbalah from what the Easterns say. You probably don't have to do that. But we see that even they, far away from the Kabbalistic, many stages removed from the Kabbalistic core, have been able to grasp the concept that spirituality is equivalent to being able to laugh. But laugh spiritually, laugh deeply. Try and understand it. What's this idea of putting together two opposites and having this experience called laughter? What does it mean? What's it mean in Torah terms? That's a deep core of what the dais is. Inner wisdom hinges at this point of what's called laughter. That's very critical to understand what it is. The worse the situation is, the worse it looks to you, the more potential it has for this kind of happiness. So the idea in Torah terms is something like this. The laughter in spiritual terms, the experience of crisis and redemption, is always the experience of the end of a process and when it changes into the opposite process. Right? The climax, the essence of this thing, is a process of destruction, and at the moment of inevitable destruction, revelation appears. Right? That's what's called funny. That's what's called laughter in spiritual terms. And many, many examples, if you think about it, you'll see it all over. It says, for example, in benching. You know, when we bench on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Shabbos and Yom Tov, which is a time when we relate to the next world. What we're talking about here is the end of a human life. Right? The end of life. When the life ends, there's a transition from one phase into the exact opposite. Whatever that phase is that's hidden from us, there's a transition. In spiritual terms, that's called funny. That's very different to the way we think about things. When the world ends, that means this phase of existence, what we call the birth or the dawn of the messianic phase, whatever that means, that transition from this phase into that phase, that's what's called humor also. So on Shabbos, when we experience a taste of the messianic revelation, or of the final transcendent spiritual revelation, when you bench on Shabbos, we say that we have a Tehillim, capital Tehillim that we say before the benching. And in that Mizmor Tehillim, it says, "Az yimalei shoik pinu," which means then our mouths will be filled with laughter. Then, so the Mefarshim say, then our mouth will be filled with laughter. And they learn a halacha, right? When is then? When the final stage of revelation, when it says that the sower meets the reaper, right? When the one who sowed the crop and saw the seed die in the ground and disintegrate in the ground, when he sees the crop rise, when there's no gap between those two events, when the juxtaposition, the sowing the seed and watching it fall and be buried and disintegrate in the ground, when that turns around into a growth, when those two meet each other, that there's no gap of sadness in between, as yimalei shoik pinu, that's when we'll laugh. That's when our mouth will be filled with laughter. And the poskim learn a halacha from this, that in this world a Jew is not allowed to laugh fully. As yimalei shoik pinu, a Jew is not allowed to laugh in this world fully. That means a complete abandon. Right? There's plenty to laugh about in this world. They're supposed to be happy. The first mitzvah of the Torah is to be happy. That's the first mitzvah. You've got to be happy always. Depression is never allowed in Jewish terms. But full laughter, that means with a grasp of the full revelation, that's only allowed in that phase. As yimalei, but not now. But you see from this, that the concept is that at that turnaround, when the sadness of the world is a very miserable place, When the sadness of this phase of existence turns around to become what we call the redemption, that's what's called laughter. There's another place you see it. It says, also on Shabbos, no accident that we say these things on Shabbos. You see it says on Shabbos, we say Eishes Chayil. We sing something written by Shlomo HaMelech. We sing Eishes, you come up from Shul. People sing Shalom Aleichem, and there's a custom many people have to sing Eishes Chayil. Eishes Chayil means a woman of valor. That is a description of the intrinsic, of the essential, what a Jewish woman's supposed to be. That's a mashal for Torah, for our relationship with Hashem, for the Jewish people, but it also means a woman. And one of the things it says about her is amazing thing. It says, "Vatischak leyoim acharon." At the day of the end, she laughs. Vatischak, she laughs leyoim acharon. The day of transition from this life to the next, she's laughing. That is, a woman has the capacity to laugh, right, at that kind of event. That means the real laughter of what a woman is. It's a woman who brings this to the world. You have to understand that a man's not able to do this. Man can only begin the process, like we've often described. Man only puts the seed in. He can only begin the process. But the one who picks up the seed and turns it around into a life, right, she takes, the earth is the woman. The earth that absorbs the seed and watches it disintegrate, but then has the power to turn it around and give back, right, something more than what was there before. That's always called female. That's why God is always referred to as the male, and the world or the earth is always referred to as female. That turnaround that the earth can do, that a woman can do, what's called birth. What's called birth is the experience of taking something, turning it around from what looks like destruction, turning it around into what looks like life. So a woman is living correctly, that means a woman is tuned to what it means to be a woman, can understand the transition into a greater phase of existence than this one, she has an experience of what's called laughter. Spiritual experience that's called laughter. The deepest source we have of this in the mystical writings is always goes around the experience of giving birth. Because the universal experience, I'll try and come back to this in more detail, but just briefly, the universal experience, what it means to give birth to a child, the mystics say that, if, again, you see it's the same rule. If you see in the world a person, there's a man and a woman, and then they have a child, then it has to be that every detail of that process has to be reflecting a spiritual call. Now, it's not just accidental the way a pregnancy and a birth goes. It's not an accident. What it is, it's a reflection of the way anything is born in the world. And everything in the world has to be born. It could be a physical thing, it could be an event, it could be a human, it doesn't matter what it is. So you understand the events surrounding the birth of a human, especially the birth of a human, which is the essence of what the world's patterned on, the human being, then you understand a very deep root in the spiritual world. So the birth of a child is an amazing experience. People who've worked with it will tell you, you see the most... Later, Mr. Shem will focus on what happens to the child during the birth, because that's even more amazing. But what happens to a woman, to the whole process, is that a process that looks like destruction turns around and becomes life. I'm not putting you off having children. It's a mitzvah, and you have to do it. But the experience is a remarkable one. Because what happens during the birth of... What happens is, all the stages follow exactly the stages of what the mystics describe as any process of crisis and redemption. Right? And the process is always that it gets worse before it gets better. Always. There's always a false relief before it gets really bad. There's always a false... Right? Anyone who's ever been in difficulty or in crisis, you don't have to, don't even have to have this discussion. People know this from their own experience. But that's what it is. An experience of terror, of crisis, a life experience, and life is like that, the whole of life is that way, is always an experience where it starts off and it gets worse. And it gets gradually worse. And then suddenly it gets exponentially worse. And when it gets as bad as you think it could be, there's a false light often that happens. That's why we have a concept of a false Mashiach. It's not an accident that we have a tradition that before the Mashiach arrives, there will be a tremendous disappointment. Tremendous, just a false experience of redemption. And then just when you think you've begun to experience that, it gets so bad that you can't possibly imagine how you could survive. And when it gets that bad, it gets worse. And when it gets to the point that you know you can't survive, and as you're about not to, if you just hang on, that's when the redemption occurs. Of course, that's when most people let go. Right? The mystics say that when it's so bad that you can't last one more minute, if you know for sure with the inner dust that you can't survive for one more minute, hold on for just one more minute, because then it's going to... That's the time for happiness. When the mystics say that it gets darker before the dawn breaks, but they're not being poetic, you follow. The mystical writings in Torah, there's no sort of poetic exaggeration. That's not what they mean. What they mean is that before the light, and that's why it's always called, if you read in Torah writing, you'll always see that the dawn is always called Bokea, right? As Yibaka Oyer, right? Oyer, it says. Then you're... Boikea, the Hebrew word, means to cleave asunder. I don't know, it's no simple English way to say that, but like to be split open at a time when you can't, that's what it means, to be cleft. That's how the dawn is described in Hebrew. Not like the night gradually fades out, then the gray. It's not what it's called. When the first thing of dawn occurs in spiritual terms, it's always called to be cleft, to be torn. The dawn tears the night open. That's what it's experienced. Because that experience of the darkest time of the night, that's an experience of the ultimate crisis. That's what it's supposed to be. That's very deeply connected to what we spoke last night about davening. This is the experience of davening Ma'ariv. The experience of davening at night time is supposed to be feeling the darkness intimately and intrinsically. Not tonight's subject. Now, so you watch the process of birth and you see this message. The way a birth goes is this. First, the woman is pregnant, slowly goes along a pathway that looks predictable. Right? It takes a long time, it takes many months, and it goes in such gradual stages that if you ask, the trouble is we're so familiar with this that we don't see the spiritual power of it. We're so familiar with it that we just yawn and say, like, another mazel tov, you know, the jump of an angel. But that's not, a person should be struck, right, by what it means when a child is born. Should be, if you took somebody who's never seen it before, and you asked him to witness the experience of what it means to bring a child into the world, that it is an awesome experience. First of all, as the pregnancy progresses, it progresses at a steady rate. So if you ask anybody, imagine after 5, 6, 7, 8 months of pregnancy, you're observing this woman every day, ask a person who's never experienced it, what is the likely progression? What's going to happen tomorrow? So you'd say probably more of the same, but bigger, but less comfortable. But you know, what happens is there comes a time when all the rules get broken. There's no gradual progression. What happens is everything's turned upside down suddenly. Now, that's the experience of crisis. What happens is it looks suddenly terrible. It looks terrible, it looks painful, it looks dangerous, and it is. Right? Anybody knows, you know, the halacha is that a woman in childbirth, you can break Shabbos for her. A woman in childbirth, through the experience of the time she goes into labor, until a certain time after childbirth, when she's called a chaya, which means a giver of life, the halacha is you can break Shabbos for her, because she's in danger. She's in danger. And it says the books get opened upstairs and she gets examined. Everything she's done in her life gets examined because it's a time of danger. She's put to the test at that time, and if she's got certain problems, takes effect then. It says a woman doesn't take challah when she bakes. It has a terrible effect then. Or she doesn't light candles on Friday night. Or she doesn't observe the laws of Nida. They all have a very powerful accusatory effect that can happen at that time when she's in danger, right? Because you're subject to. But anyway, she's going through a time of crisis and danger. That was very, first of all, it was unpredictable. Secondly, it wasn't in keeping with the pace of what happened before. Thirdly, it looks terrible. Right? It looks terrible, it feels painful, it's very sharp, and it's very dangerous. Right? It's associated with a definite danger to life. At the moment when the pain is worst, and the danger is the greatest, right? At that moment a new human being is born. And if you watch a woman who goes through that, she completely forgets that at that moment. It's completely that the total experience of crisis turns into an experience of redemption. Right? That's what it is. Now, if that happens the way a human's born into the world, you have to understand the whole world's born that way. The messianic revelation is born that way. That's why it's called, there's no accident, that the pain that will precede the coming of the Mashiach, a terrible war, says that all the nations will get together and come against Israel. Says the Western Bloc will get together with the Arabs, written clearly in the Ramban. The Western Bloc will join together with the Arabs, says clearly, and attack the Jewish people. No, the Gaon says that the war will last 12 minutes. A third of the world won't survive. A third will be injured, a third will survive. In Nach, it talks about where the bodies will be piled and how high. I mean, clear predictions about what it will be. By the way, we could change all that. It says if every Jew would keep Shabbos twice in a row, so then Mashiach would come the other way. You follow? We don't have to do it, but at the moment, we're not exactly heading. But if it goes the passive way, then that's the way it's going to be. That's what it says. Unpredictably and ungraspably awesome. And it's at the worst time of that universal cosmic crisis that the revelation will appear. But, and that process is called Chevlei Mashiach. It's called the birth pangs of the Mashiach. But it's not poetic. It literally means the birth pangs of the Mashiach. It means those pains and that bleeding, right, which the world will experience, that will bring about the redemption. That's what it has to be. And you think about many other examples that all follow the same thing. If you think about human crisis, you'll see that people who've really been squeezed in crisis, they go through exactly that experience. Now, let's try and dissect it out more carefully, more clearly, and try and understand the core of it and how it works and what that experience is. That turnaround is called laughter, right? That simcha, that cry of joy that happened at the time when it looked like death was about, that is the experience, that's what's called tzchoik. Tzchoik in Hebrew, which means laughter. Now, we'll come back to this in a session, but let's look at the root again. The root in Torah terms is this, that the concept of what's called laughing, you see very interesting, very interesting. Where do we come across that concept of laughter? So if you look in Bereshit, that's the book of creation, not Genesis. You look there, you find that when the Jewish people was about to be born, it was accompanied by laughter. When Abraham Avinu, who was the father, he's called the father, he's the Av, That's Abraham Avinu. He's the father. When he brought into the world the first Jewish child, Abraham and Sarah, you know, Yitzhak, when they had the son Yitzhak, Yitzhak was the birth of the Jewish people. Of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob together built the Jewish people. But the first child to be born after that new beginning, which was brought to the world by Abraham Avinu, was Yitzhak. So if you want to see what the birth of a Jew is, you look at the birth of Yitzhak. And from that you can understand the birth of a human, the birth of anything, the birth of the Messianic revelation. All these things go around. How was Yitzhak born? So Yitzhak was born at a moment when his birth was impossible. He was born at a time when the last thing possible on earth was that he should be born. His father was 100 years old. His mother, what? His mother was too old to have a child. And not only was she too old to have a child, in Chazal it says, Maduik in the Chumash, she didn't have the organs to have a child. She was what's called an anonis. Ain la vlad, the Gemara says, ain la base vlad, she had no womb. Sarah. She couldn't have children. Right? She was not only 90 or however old she was, but she'd never had what's called she'd never had the experience, she'd never had the organs or the physiology to have a child. So you had a couple who, from every point of view, couldn't have a child. Not only that, but mystically it was predicted in the cosmological reality. Avraham Avinu saw in his astrological structure that he was not going to have a child. But as if it wasn't enough that he could see it from his own flesh, from the fact that his wife couldn't give birth and that he couldn't, but he could see it predicted astrologically that this was never to be. In fact, when God told him that you'd have a son, he argued. He said, Hashem, but you know, you made the stars this way, not me, and the stars show clearly that I'm not going to have a child. Hashem said, yeah, don't worry, you're above all that. He took him above the stars and showed him that a Jew is above what's called mazel, that the root of what Jewish neshama is above what's predicted, and you can change predictions. That's the secret of happiness in crisis for a Jew, is that even if you make the horrendous mistake of going to people who claim to be spiritualists, or read fortunes, or tell futures, and this kind of thing, which is definitely also in Jewish terms, and even if they tell you something which is true, and it may well be true according to most of the poskim, not according to Rambam, but according to many others, they may actually be saying the truth. The point is, it's not relevant to a Jew, because a Jew, it comes from a root that's beyond the structure of the universe. Right? That's what's funny about being Jewish. That's what's really funny, is that when everything looks one way, oh, you see it in the birth of Yitzhak. The stars predicted it, his father was unable, his mother was unable. At that moment, the angels came and they said, Sarah's going to have a child. So they both laughed. They laughed. Sarah laughed. Now you see, if you've been brought up in a conventional anti-Semitic tradition, so you understand she laughed in derision, scorn. You know, you're like, you're mocking me. Sarah Imani, you understand, the woman of such emunah that she merited to found the Jewish people. She didn't laugh because the criticism of her for laughing is not what people think. The Mephoshim say that she was criticized because she didn't laugh enough. She didn't laugh enough. That was the problem with the laughing. She didn't laugh enough. Because the difference was, Avraham Avinu, it says, laughed. They laughed in two different ways. When he laughed, the mystics say that when both of them were told that Isaac would be born, so they both let out a peal of... They both laughed. Right? The difference was they laughed in different ways. It says that Avraham Avinu laughed. Sarah laughed with the happiness of the expectation of holding a child in her arms. That at a year from then, right, whenever the date would be that she'd give birth, she would experience the happiness at her age of holding her own child in her arms. She laughed with that happiness. She laughed with the happiness of the expectation of holding her child in her arms. It says that Avraham Avinu laughed with the happiness of holding his child in his arms now. That means his emunah was so great that he actually experienced it now. This is not our subject directly. Emunah is not our subject tonight, but the mystical meaning of it is that if Hashem tells you something is going to be, if in Jewish terms we have an emunah that something will be, so we rejoice about it now. Because a promise from Hashem is as good as having it. Right? When we talk about the redemption, right, we experience it now, we taste it now, we live an experience. We'll try and explain this more, but we live an experience of redemption. A Jew has to live on that plane, not in this plane. A Jew has to live in the next world. That a Jew doesn't live in this world. He lives beyond where the laughter, you follow, he lives beyond the laughter. That's what we have to do. So Avraham Avinu was on a level, a madrega, where he experienced the feeling of holding his son in his arms now. Sarah, it says, hadn't quite reached that level. She laughed with the happiness of the expectation of holding a child, and it wasn't good enough. That wasn't enough, you follow. She should have felt the happiness of it. Now, that's the criticism of... But that's another story. But the point is this, that they laughed. Yeah? The mystical meaning of that is that when they came face to face with the concept of the most incredible reversal, right, of crisis and death, right, burning out and dying, when they knew that their greatest desire was to bring into birth, into the world, the Jewish people, when that revelation became made to them, so the response that a person who's spiritually tuned has is laughter. You follow? But Yitzhak, Le'yem Achor, and Sarah was on that level, they were able to bring that kind. And the child was called Yitzhak. Yitzhak means he will laugh. Yitzhak means he will laugh. And he's called he will laugh in the future tense.
Because you follow, Yitzchak, the name Yitzchak, the child who was born, it's not an accidental that they happen to laugh at the prediction of his birth. The whole concept of his birth is laughter. The whole concept of the birth, the whole concept of what a Jew is laughter at a time when it looks like death. You follow? When despair is total, and nobody could be born, right? When they're about to die, they're that old and they couldn't possibly have a child, that's exactly when Yitzchak's born. The Jewish people begin where despair ends. That's what we are, right? When despair reaches its blackest, so that's when we begin, you follow? That's when everybody else fades away, and that's where we begin. We don't live in the same dimension as them. We live beyond the pale, right, of where the whole thing turns around. We live in the death world, but it's the real world of life. Only to them it looks the opposite way around now. But we live beyond the point of laughter. That's what it is. So Yitzchak is called Yitzchak, which means he will laugh, not now. Not now. Now the thing goes their way. It says, Eretz Nitna B'Yad Rosha. That's what it says. The world is given into the hands of the wicked. That's why it's halacha that we don't do battle with the evil in this world. We don't stand up to them. A Jew has to survive in this phase of existence by ducking between the raindrops. Because the power is given to them. You follow? To stand up for anything spiritually valid in the world today, you get smashed. Right? You follow? The din is that they have the power. The shoes on there, the power's in there. Spiritual sensitivity is not exactly, at the moment, the kind of thing that's respected, that's given credit. Right? That's not what's going on. What they're selling out there is horse meat. Right? Not spiritual sensitivity. That's what's happening. But that doesn't bother us. Right? We live when that's going to be crushed. That's when we begin. But we live now in that dimension. That's why his name is Yitzchak. He will laugh. The mystics say that if you take the word Yitzchak and you spell it out, it spells Ketzchai. The letters spell Ketzchai, which means death in life. The name Yitzchak, right, means death in life. That's what the name means. You follow? That means that in Hebrew, the same word for the future tense of laughter really means living death in this world. But it means the other side. It means the side of the redemption. We're living it now. And if you think about it for 2 minutes, you'll realize it's no accident that Yitzchak was offered as a sacrifice. Yitzchak was the one who was killed while he was alive. That means the rest of Yitzchak's life he lived after death. That he was offered as a sacrifice, and it says in the mystical writings that Ephroi shall Yitzchak munochin lefonai. The ashes of Yitzchak, right, like an oile tmima, a sacrifice that's completely burnt on the altar. His ashes, having been completely burnt, they are laid up before Hashem. That means, you follow, that the concept we have Yitzchak in the world, when he went on to be the father of Yaakov, right, when he went on to be what he became, what made him valid, what made him able to become the father who would give birth to Yaakov, which is the Jewish people, was the experience of having been offered as a sacrifice on the altar. That means the rest of his life was after having been bound on the altar and seen that knife lifted. Right? And in mystical terms, having been burnt into ash. That's what it means. Beautiful thing. So that's where we begin, you follow. We don't live on the same plane as them. Not at all. A completely different existence. And that's what's called human. That's what it means, the birth of Yitzchak. That's what the concept is of the final, the humor, that mystical humor, of the turnaround in the final dimension. Let's look at another. Let's try and look at this. Let's try and go back to the root and understand it more deeply. Since we promised to say a word or two for doctors, the Rambam says the following thing. The Rambam says if you want to understand this mystery, so you have to understand the birth of a child, but from a different point of view. The most phenomenal description is the Rambam, who was a doctor. There's no accident. Right? The Rambam himself was a practicing physician. And he writes the following description. As follows. He says this. You know, the Gemara Nida says that when a child is born, it says everything that's open, what's open closes and what's closed opens. That's what the Gemara says. A child's body, when he's inside the womb, looks one way. And when he's born, it looks another way. The Gemara puts it in one statement. The Gemara says, what's open closes and what's closed opens. That's what the Gemara says. So the Rambam says this. And if you understand deeply what happens when a child is born, that means at that moment of crisis when it looks like the mother is going through, right, mortal danger, when she enters that phase that we call crisis, right, before that redemption occurs, at that moment of crisis, what's happening to the child? That means the reality that's bringing life into the world is going through the process we described. Okay, that's an experience of crisis. What's the child going through? That means the person, we, who are going to go through this birth, right? We mystics say that the transition into the next world is going to be a birth exactly the same as this is. That means it's going to be an experience of crisis. And then the revelation that will be that you don't see now.
you don't see it until you finally get there. That is the experience of what it is to be a child becoming conscious in this world, except magnified many times. What is the experience of a human who goes through that channel? Right? What's the experience of a human? So the Rambam says this. You go back to the rules. Study what happens to a baby. Study what happens to a child as it's born. And then abstract from that what it means in spiritual terms. So the Rambam says the following thing. What we're trying to illustrate here is how the biological reality is a reflection of the spiritual core, and how accurately it reflects every detail that we've tried to explain. So he says like this. I'm paraphrasing his words for you. But he says, in effect, the following thing. When a child's unborn, I don't know, those of you who are not in the medical profession know, but when a child's unborn, so his anatomy is the opposite of a child who's born. Okay? That means there are many details that look one way in the unborn fetus, and they look not just different, but they look the opposite in the child after he's born. Yeah? And what happens is that they reverse from one to the other. For example, when the child's unborn, his whole circulation follows a pattern very, very different from the pattern of a person who's in the world. Right? His blood, he's got holes in his heart. He's got a special blood vessel that carries blood away from his lungs. Blood doesn't flow through his lungs. He's got a special major blood vessel that short-circuits the lungs. Right? The blood flows in a completely opposite direction, bypasses the lungs. He's got blood flowing out of the umbilicus, and he's got blood flowing back through the same source that goes to special veins in his liver that connect up with his venous system that an adult doesn't have. Right? He's got a whole physiological makeup of his hemoglobin, the way his blood functions. There's a special type of system where it absorbs oxygen in a certain way, the opposite to the way adult hemoglobin does. He's got a whole system of where he produces his blood cells, different from the way an adult does, it transitions after he's born. Many, many aspects of a child's physiology are very, very different anatomy from what an adult is. Now, when a child's born, what happens is those things reverse themselves and they become the opposite. But, Rambam pointed out much more sensitively than that. You see, if you went to medical school, if you're unfortunate enough to go to medical school, they didn't teach you the premise of it. So then you thought, you know, it took a couple of million years to get it right. You followed a couple of million monkeys that didn't make it. And then they sort of got it right. And then but you understand, it isn't like that. The Rambam points out that if you watch it carefully, you see the following thing. The features that the child has are not just different from the features that a child, the features that a fetus has are not just different from the features of a child that's born. They're exactly the opposite. And they're so opposite that every one of them is essential for a child to stay alive in the womb, but it would be death if he had it when he's outside. And conversely, every feature that you have when you're born, when you're outside, you need critically for life. And if you would have one of the features that the fetus has, when you die. That means they're not just different things. They're life and death differences. Right? Understand the picture. Here's this fetus, right, inside its mother. So first of all, it lives underwater. That's a death condition for somebody in the world. He doesn't have any air to breathe. Right? Even if he could, his lungs don't function. His lungs have never expanded once. His lungs are completely tightly contracted and collapsed. Even if that weren't true, there's no blood flowing through his lungs to get oxygenated. Yeah? Each of the feet, he's got holes in his heart that are lethal for a human. He's got a major blood vessel shunting blood away from his lungs. If a child, if a person lives in the world and has that thing open, he's finished. So he has, right, if blood flows out of the umbilicus, right, if all these things happen that reverse all the... If any of those things happen to the child while he's in that environment, while the child's in that environment, he needs all those things. If you were to try to change one of them to what you and I have, you'd kill him. When a child's born, he lives exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite. What's closed opens, what's open closes. He lives in the world now breathing air, right? But, I have to understand that, see, let's try and make it a bit more graphic. Here's this child in the womb. He's living perfectly adapted to his environment, right? He's got this whole circulation that works perfectly, right? He gets blood from the placenta, it circulates in this way through the holes in his heart, reversing the flow. The whole thing works perfectly and it keeps him alive, right? Everything's perfect. Suddenly, after months and months and months of this perfect existence, suddenly the pain and the terror and the danger begins. Right? Imagine if a child had consciousness. The Geshe Rachaim speaks this way about two twins in the womb. What the one thinks while the other one's being born. He says goodbye. He says he sees death. The twin that's left behind sees his environment as life, and he sees his brother passing out into the world. He mourns. Because he sees a child that's got everything that it needs to live being cast out into a world where every feature that he has spells death. That means life is absolutely impossible out there. The child's going to be born into a world where every feature that he has that keeps him alive now is going to spell death out there. You follow? And there's no feature out there that could keep him alive. What happens? The child's born.
And you witness, anybody's been privileged to be present or to experience such a thing, you can actually witness and feel these things happening. As the child's born, the first thing that happens is, he starts to die. That's the first thing that happens, he goes blue. The first thing that happens, he starts to die. Which the mystics always say, that at the point of intensity of a crisis, not only does it get to its final and worst thing, but there's a further stage that actually proves that it's finished. Right? And you have to keep your head together in that phase. It's not only you have to keep your head together while you're going through the experience of crisis. It's even after it's finished and over and done with and proved that it's over, even then you have to keep your emunah that it's going to be all right. You know that. The mystics say that when a person transitions into the next world, the first thing that happens is not the redemption and not the revelation. The first thing that happens is complete blackness and nothingness. That's the first thing that happens. And in that moment of blackness, the Yetzer Hara comes to you. Your own negativity comes to you and says, you see, I told you there's nothing over here. And if a Jew says in that moment, yeah, you're right, loses everything. You have to, even after you've experienced that, even if after you've experienced the proof that nothing's valid, you still have to keep yourself together and then so here's this child is being born. The first thing that happens is he starts to die. Within minutes, that's completely miraculous. Within minutes, within 4 minutes, like a critical time period, what's open closes and what's closed opens. If you listen with your stethoscope, you can see it, you feel it, you experience it happening. That major blood vessel that takes blood away from the lungs suddenly miraculously closes down. Completely miraculously closes. No one knows how, by the way. No physiologist has yet discovered what it is that makes that happen. But it suddenly closes down, and blood, instead of going backwards, goes into the lungs. At that moment, just at that moment, you follow the blood, the lungs pop open, the child takes his first breath. As it gets blood through the lungs, it gets oxygen into the thing, and the two of them meet. At exactly that moment, the umbilical cord, the blood that's pouring blood out of his body to his death, suddenly the vessel's clamped down. You can feel it. If you hold your hand, if you hold the umbilical cord in your hand, you suddenly feel the vessel stop pulsating. They clamp down. Child stops bleeding. At exactly that moment, you follow? The holes in his heart close. Yeah. So that must have taken a good few million years, you follow? to get all that coordinated by accident, you follow? That takes... So but that's obvious nonsense to think that way. So it's nonsense to think that way. There was such a pull the wool over our eyes, it was. Nothing could be more purposeful. Nothing could be more critically planned to function together. And it all happens exactly together. And within 4 minutes, the child is living in exactly the opposite phase of what he was before. He is now tuned into a world where everything that he has now is life for him. And if you'd reverse one of them, he'd die. Right? And that's what it is. That's the experience. Right? See, the Rambam said this because he was accused by a certain sect. Certain people came to the Rambam and they said, you Jews are wicked because you claim that there's a redemption after the crisis. You Jews claim there's life after death. You Jews claim there's a resurrection, there's life after death. And you're wicked to claim it because if you experience the world honestly, you don't see it. That's what they said to him. If you look at the world, you'll see life goes to death. You do not see that death goes to life. Look at the world. You'll see anything dies and decays. You will not see things that reverse that from death come to life. You won't see it. So the Rambam explained this to them. The Rambam said it's a hidden process. But if you look deeply, if you know where to look, you know how to uncover the covers on the world, look behind the mask, then you do see it. The most critical, important thing in the world is to see a human born. And when you watch a human being born, you see exactly that. You see what looks like a definite death process and you see it reverse. That's our example. That's what we always come back to. And we want to understand how bad it can look in a crisis and how... Now, a few weeks ago when we met, we discussed the fact that there are midrashim, I'm not going to go through the examples again, but there are midrashim that predict what the final war will look like in terms of, right? You remember we said a few weeks ago that there are midrashim that say that miraculous fire will come from heaven, whatever this means, right? There will be proofs from the transcendent dimension that we are wrong and everybody else is right. There will be proofs. But that we're wrong, that Torah is wrong, that everybody else is right and we're wrong. And after the proofs are manifest in the world, that's when the final redemption. That means the final test of Jewish emunah will be to live. It's easy now. But to be a frum Jew now is easy. That's an obvious thing to do. To be a frum Jew now because it's only pleasure. To live out there, see, many people who have become observant will tell you, many young people will tell you, not even anyone ever expresses admiration for them, they'll say they're not. There's nothing to be admired. It's just taking the easy way out. What could be better than having a Shabbos with a family together? What could be better than Jewish married life together? Not according to what could be better than relating to the children, your children, the way it's supposed to be? Right? Religious children can't fathom how people without Shabbos survive without what a Shabbos really is. Right? Without the concept of meaning in life. If you think you're really a monkey, you're going to disintegrate one day. So life's an agony. Now, let's
try and take one more example and we'll leave it at that. You see, the important thing for us to understand is this, that when crisis becomes redemption, right, in a personal ordeal, could be this way, or in all the elements that we've discussed, the important thing to realize is this, that when the thing reverses itself suddenly, right, we're describing that experience of sudden reversal, that's what's called funny, is a very important catch. Right? The catch is that, see, if you think about it carefully, you'll see that in the examples we've used, you didn't hear too many people laughing. In other words, the idea is this. When the transition occurs, it's only funny if you're not part of the joke. It's not funny that the person who falls on his back, the person who slips and falls on his back, isn't laughing at all. That person doesn't see the humor at all. The only time that this experience is funny is when you're standing on the side watching it. When you're part of what's getting reversed, it's not funny at all. But the mystics say there's no greater pain than the experience of being turned inside out. But when the world turns itself inside out and upside down, so then that's tremendously painful. The only laughter in the situation is the person is watching it happen. You follow? When a person suffers the embarrassment of being turned inside out, right in front of, so the experience, the only part, the humor is only the person who isn't getting turned upside down. Not the person. So let's try and see this in Torah terms, understand how serious the subject is. When it says that a woman is able, that a woman is able to laugh at that day, it means a woman has got herself upside down already. The aim of Jewish living is to be upside down now. The aim of Jewish living is to look different from the rest of the world now, not to chase after the same things they chase after, to live a material existence where only this world means something. Because if only this world means something, when this world's taken away, that's tremendously painful. When the spiritual revelation is revealed, right, that the only thing that counts is the spiritual existence, and you spent the whole lifetime chasing after the physical existence, and it suddenly just disappears in one instant, so that's not going to be funny at all. The trick of Jewish living is to turn yourself upside down in this phase, right? The trick of Jewish living is to live Yitzchak, to live after the laughter, after the sacrifice. It's to live in the death phase now. It's to be a spiritual being in this phase. So when the world gets turned upside down, it means gets turned the right way up. You're already the right way up. That's what the Mephoshim say. That's why the Gemara says that the pain of the Messianic revelation, that's so intense, there's even one place in the Talmud that says, let it come, but let me not see it. That means that it's a sophic, it's a doubt whether we'll be able to stand that revelation. Right? It'll be so intense. So the Mephoshim say the only way to survive is to be completely immersed in Torah. A person is completely immersed in Jewish values and mitzvahs and Torah, that person won't feel the pain. That's what they say. What's the depth of understanding of it? The idea of being immersed in Torah means to be immersed in a spiritual existence where the meaningful things in life are meaningful to you, right? Where life really means what it should mean. Now, despite the fact that that the secular world, that the Western, right, what's built up in Western terms, is to pursue only the physical and the temporal and what's meaningful now, right? Despite that, but the Jewish thing is to live the opposite way. That's what it means to be in Torah. Even though you get laughed at, you might get laughed at. But it's to be attached to spiritual values. So when the physical thing disappears, so you'll be singing. That's the idea. You'll be laughing. That's what it means. But not if you're part of the joke. So the classical example of this, and we'll end with this. The classical example in Jewish terms, always when we want to understand this, we go back to the root. And we see that the root of it in Jewish terms is the birth of Yitzchak. And we know that Maaseh Avos Simen Labanim, whatever happened to the fathers is always reflected in the events of the children. You know? If you understand something happened to Avraham Avinu, then it must happen later to the Jewish people as a whole. It always has to be that way. We always learn these realities in two ways. One is we look in the Torah, and the other is we look at the world. When we want to understand this from the world, we see the birth of a child. We see what reversal from death to life means, even though it looks the opposite. When we want to look in Torah, we look in two places. One, we look at the birth of Yitzchak, because that's the place where it happened to the Avos, the fathers, the forefathers. And then we look at where it first happened to the Jewish people. We want to understand what it means to go through that, especially women, because birth is always from women. But you want to understand what it means that within woman, this transition occurs. She's the one who merits to bring it to the world. That means a man can bring the seed, but the one who experiences the turnaround, the one who experiences the danger and the happiness, that's what's called the Malchus, which is what a woman's supposed to be in the world, and it happens only in a hidden place. We've discussed some of these things before. Then we look at the birth of Yitzhak and we see what Sarah went through. When we want to see what happens to the Jewish people, then we look at the experience of the brothers in Egypt. We look at that experience. Let's look carefully at Joseph and his brothers, just for a few minutes. After another few minutes, let's look at the experience of Joseph and the brothers. We'll give our undramatized version, you understand? There have been others. You give the correct, yeah? The correct one, you understand?
So our Torah shouldn't be chasasom sichel b'tanah shalahem. Shouldn't be like that. To understand what happened over there, to understand what really, not the way it was taught anti-Semitically to Haida kids who were 6 years old, not the wrong way, anti-Jewish values, but to understand the spiritual content of it. You see a story over there of crisis and redemption. You see a story of what got worse. When it looked as bad as it could be, it got worse than that. Right? You follow? Always like that. When it looked like it was about to be okay, then it really got bad. Right? And then, let's understand, because that's the core. You have to keep coming back to that. You want to be prepared for the messianic plane. The person wants to be prepared for any personal crisis or the final cosmic crisis. It's a Jewish obligation to understand carefully what it says in Chumash and to understand exactly what it's going to look like so you can be prepared. Because the only way to have emunah when the crisis is that bad that it seems impossible to bear is if you're prepared. Look what happened to the brothers, just for a few minutes, and you'll see the most amazing experience of crisis. These brothers, right, they sold Joseph. That's where they went wrong. They were not going to go into the justification of what they thought they were doing. It doesn't matter. They made a judgment. They made a decision that they had to kill him. They decided to sell him, and they got rid of him. Immediately after doing that, the world crashed. Their world collapsed. Their whole world crashed. They were given a proof immediately that they'd done something wrong. They saw immediately that they'd done wrong, and there's no way to recover. There was no way to recall to wipe out the damage that they'd done. When they presented the coat, you remember the coat of colors, to their father, so he went into mourning, such intense mourning, immediately, he lost all prophetic insight. Right? Poska nevuah soi. That means his nevuah, his connection to the spiritual world, his ability to hear Hashem speaking to him directly, ended immediately. When that happened, the brothers realized that they'd blown it. They'd blown the future of the world. Because Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, saw in Joseph, he saw in Yosef, the future of the Jewish people. That's a deep reason why, but it's because in the mystical tradition, there's a tradition that there must be a Messiah, a Mashiach from the house of Joseph, Mashiach ben Yosef, before the Mashiach ben David. And he will give over and prepare the world for the final revelation. Without Joseph, there's no redemption. Yaakov Avinu knew that. When Joseph disappeared, Yaakov Avinu went into such intense mourning, right, that it became manifest to the brothers that they'd ended the future of the world. Because the world is only created for the Jewish people. Right? The Jewish people are created only to bring Torah to the world. If there's going to be no Jewish people to receive Torah at Sinai, to bring Torah into the world doesn't exist. We're talking here about losing the cosmic reality. We're talking about losing the universe. It says in Loi Brisi Yomam V'Laila, Chukai Shamayim V'Aretz Loi Samti. If it wouldn't be for my covenant, that means for Torah, day and night, then I would put the world back to the formless void that it was before. That means if, right? So the Jews were heading, right, the agony of the Jewish mothers, Sarah, Rachel, right, and Leah, Rivka, Rachel and Leah, the agony, their only purpose in life was to bring the Jewish people into existence. That's all they wanted. They wanted to bring into existence a world, a nation, that reflected what their husbands were, the greatness of their husbands, that's what they wanted. Now, that's all the Jewish desire was, to bring the Jewish people into the world, to bring Torah, spirituality into the world, and bring the universe to its final perfection. When the brothers saw that the crux of it had been the line that was going to go through Joseph, and their father had lost his connection to the spiritual world, they suddenly realized that they'd ended the future of the world. That means there was going to be no Jewish people. This is what they thought. Yeah? Now, that's a crisis. That's how they continued living for the years that ensued, I don't know. Yeah? They lived with a consciousness that they'd made the biggest mistake ever in history. Yeah? Possibly secondary only to what Adam Arishan did wrong. But they'd blown the future of the world. Yeah? But it didn't get better. It got worse. And it got worse for 22 years. Right? If you work it out in Chumash, you'll see that the amount of time that Jacob lived, Yaakov Avinu lived without his prophecy, he lived for 22 years in the sure knowledge that mourning for his son Yosef, in the sure knowledge that there was no future. And it didn't just last a day or a month that they could recover from. Day after day, year after year, the same crisis continued. Right? That takes incredible greatness to be able to survive. Imagine. But at the end of 22 years, it didn't get better. It got much worse. Now, just like the process of birth goes gradually and then suddenly it becomes exponentially a crisis, that's what happened. What happened? At the end of 22 years of consciousness of what they've done wrong, they started to starve. Now, there was a famine in the land, famine in Canaan, and they start starving to death. Immediately the brothers know that it's because of what they did wrong. They know they're being punished and tortured and tormented because they did something wrong, and they accept it. When they're about to starve to death finally, Yaakov says to them, go down to Egypt. Unbeknown to them, their brother Joseph is ruling Egypt. All the food in the world, right, in the whole known world, the whole world culture was centered in Egypt. And unknown to them, that all the food supplies in the world are controlled by their brother Joseph. Right? They don't know who he is. So Yaakov says, go down and buy us food. Right? So they go down to Egypt. And as they arrive in Egypt, the crisis becomes unbearable. Because he seizes them. Right? He accuses them of being spies. You remember the story. And he starts tormenting them.
He starts asking them questions, where they come from and their family and all, and they let slip the fact that they have a young brother, Benjamin. Not Binyamin, young brother back home, the last remaining child, the only surviving child of Rachel, right? Rachel Imanu had only two sons, Joseph and Binyamin. The last vestige of any emotion that Yaakov has in the world is that boy Binyamin. And he's kept him at home for safekeeping. So Yosef says, fine, take the food. You can all go home. I'm going to keep Shimon as a hostage. All I want is Binyamin. Just bring him down. I want to see if he's telling the truth. That's the end of the world for them. Because they know that to get their father to part with Binyamin, that's going to virtually cause his death. Right? They've got themselves into him, and they turn to each other. The brothers turn to each other and they say, it's because of what we did. It's because of what we did to our brother. And they were right. And Joseph was putting them through this experience, and this is a critical issue to grasp in crisis, that every aspect of the crisis is for your correction. Joseph was tormenting them, not as revenge. He was trying to make them go through the same experience that they'd gone through 22 years before, and this time get it right. He wanted them to bring the same source. He wanted them to bring Binyamin, a brother of the same mother. Right? And this time, when he wanted to take the life of Binyamin, he wants the brothers to stand by him this time instead of sell him out. Right? In the jealousy that they felt for a son of Rachel last time that they sold him out, this time he wants them to do complete tshuva, complete repentance, get it right, and this time defend the brother, defend that competitor, right? That brother from the other mother. This time defend him with their life. And that will affect the tshuva and perfect the Jewish people. They don't know that. Because in crisis, you don't know what it's doing for you. Every step of a crisis looks completely confusing. That's the worst part of a crisis. You follow. If you knew you were going through a crisis and it was all meaningful and it was correct, it would be easy. You'd be singing through the crisis. The problem is while you're going through it, you can't understand what it's doing. That's the agony of a crisis. That it looks so meaningless. So unfair. And that's what they thought. But in the end, there's nothing they can do. So he takes the hostage, he takes Shimon, he locks him up, and the brothers go back. Okay? The brothers go back. On the way, they find the money returned in their sacks. Just to add to the confusion. Right? You find that nothing makes sense when you're in crisis. Every single detail of your life just convinces you more that nothing's meaningful at all. Right? That's the test of Emunah. Right? See many smiling faces. People have been through difficulty. That's what happens. Anyway, so they go back to the thing and they tell their father, listen, we got the food, here it is. You got a breathing period, but we've got Shimon back behind. And this tormentor over there says he wants to see Binyamin. So the father says, there's no way you're going to take Binyamin away from me. You did that once before, right? You lost a brother before. The last flash of any memory I have is this boy. You're not going to take him away. And he doesn't let him go until they're starving to death. Until they are literally starving to death. They finished all the food, and the next step is death. So it's either all of them die, including Binyamin, or send him down to Egypt. So Yaakov's got no choice. And that's how it is in crisis, by the way. Your options, you squeeze to the wall. Right? You don't sit in control, able to make decisions. That's how crisis is. It squeezes you into exactly what it was you didn't want to do. That's how crisis always is. So he lets him go. So now he's sitting at home. He's lost Yosef 22 years before, and he's just said goodbye to Binyamin. Now, that's how the brothers feel. They've done this to their father. Okay? That's how they feel while they're taking Binyamin down to Egypt. Fine. When they get there, it doesn't get better. It gets much worse. Much worse. Because Yosef says to them, that's fine. I see you're telling the truth. I'll tell you what. Take all the food. He gives them food. And he sends them back. And that's the false sense of revelation. They're riding back to Egypt. Imagine. They're on their animals, right? They're riding back in the caravan. They've got all the food with them. They've got Binyamin with them. They're on their way home, right? Everything's... Right? Looks... Somebody comes chasing after them. Who is it? Menashe. Comes chasing after them. Yosef's other son. They don't know who it is. And he forces them to open all the things. And in the sack of Binyamin, they find the cup, right? The precious divining cup of Yosef. Why did Yosef put it in Binyamin's sack? Obviously. He wanted the brothers to think that Binyamin was a threat to them. He was the thief who got them into trouble. To put them into a tremendous test of turning against that young brother. And this time, despite all the evidence against him, to get it right and not do it. That's an incredible ordeal he put them through. You follow? His love for them as a brother was to put them back in exactly the same situation. It was critical. The future of the world depended on it. You follow what Kumash is telling us? Brought up in anti-Semitic kind of thing. You know, there were some brothers and I hated their brothers, so they sold him away and they went this way, went that way, a bit of food, a bit of... You know, that nonsense anti-Semitic education that was. These are cosmic events. Every detail of the future, the world depends. We don't have to grasp that. That's what Torah is. Anyway, so at that moment, the brothers turn around and they see Binyamin has let them down. He's stolen this cup. He says he hasn't, but they... And this time, instead of selling out the brother, they get it right. And they say, we're all going back with him. And they go back with him. And Joseph says to them, when they come face to face at the final moment, the showdown, Joseph says, look, this boy has done something wrong. He's going to stay with me. Let him pay. Let's be fair. He stole this thing. He stays with me. Let him pay the price. You can all go home. The brothers turned to each other. It says in Mefarshim, it says in Midrash, that the brothers turned to each other. At that moment, their world ended. At that moment, the world ended. Because at that moment, the only next step was total obliteration and death, oblivion. Because the only options open to them were going back to Yaakov, Right? One option was going back to Yaakov Avinu. And the Mephoshim say that if they would have arrived back in Canaan without Binyamin, when Yaakov would have seen them in the distance and just counted them, before they could even speak to him to explain, he would have died of grief on the spot. Right? He would have died of grief on the spot. That means their one option, you follow, was to leave Binyamin the way Yosef demanded, go back, right, go back to without Binyamin, and kill Yaakov Avinu. That means kill Yisrael. Kill Yaakov Avinu on the spot. The other option was destroy the world. They were superhuman in strength, right? That's our mystical concept, what it means. But they were of superhuman strength. And the other option was to lay Egypt low, was to wipe out Egypt physically. That means destroy the whole of the known world culture at the time, to destroy the whole country, right? Raise everything to the ground, and take Binyamin home, but kill the world in the process. You know, Yehuda turned to his brothers and he said, look, you each take one town and I'll take three and we'll wipe the place out. According to one opinion, you take each one suburb and I'll take the three of this town. According to another opinion, you each take one town, one province, one area of Egypt, I'll take three. Between us, we'll wipe out the place. The Midrash says amazing things. It says Yehuda picked up a marble table. Yosef, Yaakov had a marble table, solid block of marble weighing many, many tons. Yehuda threw it up in the air and crashed it to a powder, right, to show Yosef that he was being serious. And it says that Shimon let out a yell, let out such a yell that the palace of Paro in another town trembled, started shaking. Right? In fact, he was so angry, Shimon was in such danger of taking the whole place apart himself. That, by the way, you think the movies have got drama. The Midrash says Shimon was in such danger of taking the place apart by himself that Yosef saw that he was too dangerous. Yosef saw he couldn't let Shimon continue to be part of the ordeal. Because Shimon, so he sent his son Menashe, who was 7 years old, by the way, to knock him out. And it says Menashe came up, he gave him a certain kind of a blow, and he think when Shimon woke up in prison, he said, that boy's got to be one of us. Because there was nobody could, it was too late. He said, that's what it says. No, just Midrash. And Shimon was out the way. But be that as it may, the point is that it was a showdown, okay? It wasn't funny. It wasn't funny to them. At that moment they stood there, and Yehuda said like this, the only options we have, let's get it again, the only options are going back to Canaan and killing Yaakov, or wiping out the place. So Yehuda stepped forward and he said to Yosef the following words. He said to him, look, he made it clear to him that if he wasn't going to listen, they were going to wipe out the whole country. And he said to him the following words, and this is the way a crisis ends. You have to understand. You have to give yourself over to it. You have to know what's important. You have to give up. I'm not going to say too much about it. You have to hear the marshal and you'll be able to work it out. Yehuda stepped forward and he said to Yosef, take me. So he said, take me. He said, look, I promised my father that I'd bring him back. I promised. I promised by the life of my two sons. That's what he said. I promised by my life that I'd bring this boy back. It wasn't his fault, it was me. Right? I was responsible. I was the king, I was the leader. We sold our brother. It was my fault, take me. At that moment of self-sacrifice, right? At that moment of self-sacrifice where the world's lost, right? The only thing is either he's going to be taken, the whole world's going to disappear, they're going to go back and kill Yaakov. At that moment of impossible torment and crisis, Yosef says to them, Ani Yosef. Imagine what those words. Can you imagine what that experience was? That means at the least possible moment, right, where the only next step was oblivion, right, at that least possible moment, they heard the word. And where did they hear it from? The last possible place on earth. The source of the torment, you understand? Not only was it the least possible, the last possible moment, but it was the most impossible place that the redemption could come from, that the source, the message in that, the mystics say, is that the redemption is the crisis. That you only put through that crisis because of what it does to you. And you don't see it at the time. Avada you don't see it at the time, they only saw death at the time. Right? But when they saw it, you understand? And of course the experience of redemption is that when you go through that, not only do you feel the happiness and the joy and the relief of it, but you suddenly understand how every detail of the crisis was needed. They suddenly understood now that they'd been put through the experience of tshuva. They suddenly understood now that every detail of what they'd been squeezed into that looked so impossible and so unfair was their salvation, because the world was saved through that. Because of the fact that they were squeezed into having to give up a brother again, and agonizingly have to go through the same thing, and because they stood up to it this time, so that means, right? It's like when a woman gives birth, she relishes every pain, right? When she's given birth already. So she relishes the idea, she understands that every pain was what gave that child life. She doesn't regret it anymore. Right? That's what it is. When you finally see, that's what it is. The final word is this, though. Right? The unfunny part is this. When Yosef said to them, Ani Yosef, they didn't laugh at all. The Chumash doesn't say they laughed. The Chumash says they were so shocked by that redemption, they couldn't move. They couldn't move. They didn't flinch a muscle. They stood there. Yosef had to walk up to them. He sent everyone out when he revealed himself to his brothers. That's a private experience. That's an intimate experience. When he revealed himself to the brothers, he walked up to each one. He had to kiss each brother. He had to kiss and hug each brother. He had to speak to them in Lashon Kodesh. He had to speak to them in a special, what we call Hebrew. He had to speak to them in that language to show that he knew, to show who he was. And it says he had to show them his circumcision. Because they couldn't believe. They couldn't relate. You follow? The idea is that it's not funny. You have to understand what's going on here. That these brothers were the greatest men on earth. Okay? They were the greatest humans alive. They only made one mistake in their lives, virtually, and they just corrected that. Okay? You understand at what peak of spiritual perfection they were standing. They were the future of the Jewish people, right? They were the source of what became the Jewish people, the future of the world. They, at that level of greatness, had only made one mistake in their lives, virtually, and they just corrected that, and they still couldn't stand the pain of the redemption. Sorry. They weren't yet laughing. So what are we going to feel like? What does it mean for us? That means, but this like Yom Acharon, that means she's going to laugh at the day. That means somebody, my Rebbe once said, it's going to be like, the experience is like, you see someone, you know, you gave an example, but it means like, to see someone turned inside out. That's the pain, that's the experience. I mean, it says that the sun, the mystics say, whatever this means, the sun will come out of its casing, the sun, in that day, right, will be taken out minartiko, that means like out of its shield, and the sun will shine fully, unshielded by its special shield that it has, and the light that will shine out of the sun at that time will fry the Rishoyim. That means people who are not tuned, right? The people who have lived negatively. Whatever that means, people who have lived for the destruction of the world. They will be completely melted into smoke, out of existence, and it will heal the spiritual, right? It will heal the imperfections of the people who have been tuned, who tried to live something. Right? That's what it will be. But it means the same thing. It's not two different things. It's not one source will cause this. The same thing will be for the one hand. Oh. Which means the final revelation, that's what it will be. If you're strong enough to survive it, that means if you manage to turn yourself close enough to perfection so that you could stand that shock. The brothers went through a tremendous shock and they survived it. Right? That's what's going to be with the Jewish people. That's what will be. And the thing is, you have to add, I heard my Rebbe put it this way, that you shouldn't be mistaken. Just because we look in Chumash doesn't mean, because we look in Chumash for the source of these things, doesn't mean that when the final difficulty comes that we'll be smiling and we'll say, well, look, we know how this is going to end. Right? Because we know we have an example in Chumash. All we have to do is wait until it's impossible. We'll all turn to each other, right? We'll all say to each other, listen, not so bad. Now that it seems bad, hold on, it's going to get worse. When it gets worse, we'll say to each other, right, this is nearly it. Now, where's the redemption going to come? All we'll do is we'll look for the last possible place on earth and we'll say that. That doesn't mean that, you follow. It means that it's going to be, it doesn't work that way. Just like they at their level didn't know, so we won't know either. You follow? It's going to squeeze us as much as it squeezed them. You follow? It doesn't mean that it will be easy for us. The only thing is that their experience and what they went through will be just enough for us to hold on. That means it will be enough to give us the emunah, that we connected to Torah, we see that it happened before, it will give us enough emunah, that we could get to that stage, we could be that woman, right? That woman of valor. We're supposed to be a woman. Knesset Yisrael is supposed to be the bride of Hashem. The Jewish people is supposed to be that woman who brings life into the world. We're supposed to feel those pains, right? Men and women, the Jewish people. It has to come from women. It says, as we've tried to explain many times, it has to be women that lift the Jewish men. Jewish women have to lift Jewish men to that point of redemption, right? The men can't do it by themselves, like always happened at every point of redemption. It was always the women who brought that. But if women do that, and they bring us, and together we're able to bring that thing, to be able to withstand those pains, so then it could be, that's just like the Yom HaFam.